From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Trump administration is deflecting criticism that it's not responding quickly enough to hurricane recovery in Puerto Rico. More military help has been sent, and shipping restrictions have been lifted to send supplies to the island on foreign ships. Today, Homeland Security Advisor Tom Bossert said that federal teams have assessed most of the hospitals on the island and that media reports are outdated. Most hospitals are ready to take back patients. But that's in contrast with the view of Dr. Maria Rodriguez, who told CNN yesterday today, her community health center might have to shut down if they don't get help soon.
What else we can do? The only thing we can do is go into the shelter, do the medical evaluation, but we can't provide medications to those patients.
Let's get the ground level view from Dr. Robert Fuller, who's chair of emergency medicine at the University of Connecticut Health Center. He's on a medical mission in Puerto Rico with the International Medical Corps and has been visiting clinics and hospitals on the island. Dr. Fuller, they are depending on diesel-powered generators. What have you seen?
So what we've seen in the hospitals is the impact of the lack of power. The hospitals are having to shrink their footprint of capability. They don't have enough power to power up the whole building. Lots of buildings have some damage to some of their infrastructure, but it's the lack of power that's limiting their ability to do care.
And we're hearing anecdotally about emergency rooms with floors slick with condensation because they don't have the air conditioning that they need and there's humidity.
Yeah, so this is important. You know, operating rooms have really specific conditions to work. The humidity has to be right, the temperature has to be right, or you can't do a good surgery. We've been kind of working at the primary care levels to try to keep people away from hospitals. But what we're seeing is the hospitals that have power and can do some services, people flood them. Dialysis is particularly interesting at hospitals. Most outpatient dialysis is kind of a routine daily treatment. If you went to your neighborhood dialysis center and it's closed, where do you go next? You head to the hospital. The hospital might be set up for a small number of inpatient dialysis care, and suddenly they're responsible for community-level dialysis care.
And we've been talking about how insulin-dependent people who have to keep their insulin cold don't have the ice or the refrigerators anymore, and so that's frightening.
But a vial of insulin can sit at room temperature for 30 days and still be valuable. So what the pharmacists have been doing, because they're right on top of this, is they've been giving one vial of insulin to their diabetic patients and instructing them that it's okay, don't throw it away, it's safe and reasonable to use this medicine for a whole month, and giving them one vial.
Right. Talk about the pharmacies. We hear that the pharmacists are setting up on the sidewalks, trying to sell medications to people. But one heartbreaking story about a man who needed a very important mental health medication. The pharmacist was willing to sell it to him on the street for 25 cents a pill. He didn't even have the 25 cents a pill because there's no ATMs and there's no banking and there's no credit card usage. Talk about how that affects.
And there's no communication. You know, you and I are talking. Fortunately, we're in San Juan, but as soon as I leave San Juan, yesterday we did a big loop around the island clockwise, came back through the middle of the island. The pharmacists are now kind of using a horse and pony kind of system where they put a list together, they give it to someone to get on their motorcycle and drive to a distributor and see what medications the distributor can dispense, and then they send them back to them the next day. It's cumbersome. But they have a pretty good handle on it. It's the lack of power that's going to have this downstream effect that can tumble down to lots of different diseases. And frankly, the impact on people's life is just amazing.
Give us more of a sense of that. I mean, as a doctor, you know, something that might be a small thing that becomes a big thing because maybe somebody's elderly and it's roiling hot, but also they have no way of getting out of their small town to get medical care.
Well, there are a lot of centers that have this paucity of patients, and there's this kind of discussion about where are all the patients? And to my view, it's pretty obvious. They're worried about whether they're infirmed or whether they have just a chronic illness that they manage. They have to worry about getting water first. They might spend half their day worrying about water, shelter, and security, then food. And fuel, as you've seen, is incredibly difficult to come by. So if you finally get fuel, then you have to prioritize, what are you going to use that fuel for? Are you going to use it to go to the clinic and get your medications, or are you going to go find some food or go check on your family member in a few towns over because you haven't heard from them if there's no cell service? So I feel like people are pushing down on their priority list their health care, but that will eventually have some downstream health consequences, especially people with active chronic illnesses.
Yeah. Look, you have said that the good news here is we're not talking about, let's say, a devastating earthquake with hundreds already dead or injured that need the medical care.
Mm-hmm. But here it feels as if the problems are, you know, the infected cut that doesn't get treated or the small thing that becomes a big thing because of the lack of fuel or water. We've heard doctors there, Puerto Rican doctors there on the island, say that they worry that while the death toll was relatively low in the teens from the storm, it could be in the hundreds if these people with chronic illnesses can't be reached.
I completely agree with that sentiment. It might be the elderly person that can't get out of their home that ends up dying because they didn't get to food or water. That person might just as well have not gotten to their medicines. There's a certain cariño is the word they hear, sweetness or kindness that Latinos have, and Puerto Ricans certainly have that. And their love and respect for their elderly, whether they're primary family or neighbors, is really intense. And I know that they're being checked on. But again, that inability to move because there's no fuel, and the inability to communicate with people because there's no cell service, zero ability to communicate with people except face-to-face, is such an incredible hindrance.
Well, Dr. Robert Fuller, again, chair of emergency medicine at UConn Health, on a medical mission there in Puerto Rico. We're speaking to him in San Juan. He's with the International Medical Corps. You know, thank you so much for being there. I know you flew down on an empty, was it a United Airlines plane that was bringing back?
That was really, of all the, you know, bad airline flights anybody might ever have had in their life, boy, this was fantastic. United kindly put us on this empty plane they were sending down. It was a humanitarian flight, so a volunteer crew. We were the only three passengers, and the crew, and by crew I mean not just the flight attendants, but the deck crew, the baggage crew, the maintenance crew, the security crew. They sent down an entire team of people, all volunteers, to help evacuate a plane full of people. And it was, what a great spirit going down there. It was just wonderful.
And you among them. Thank you.
Thank you for your time. Have a good day.
Well, thanks to Hurricane Irma, the one before Maria that hit Florida, the price of orange juice is expected to rise more than $2 a gallon in the coming weeks. The storm slammed into the heart of South Florida's prime farming region, which produces tomatoes, peppers, beef, and citrus for much of the country. As NPR's Frank Morris reports, Irma came ashore when the state's agriculture industry was already struggling.
Nobody knows South Florida farming better than Gene McAvoy, who advises farmers for the University of Florida. But to get to his place, you have to drive through a lot of mud and down tree limbs, and then brave his guard geese.
We were where the Hurricane Irma ran over us and gave us a good drubbing.
McAvoy raises cattle out here in the south central Florida countryside, and all his animals made it through the storm. But he doesn't have to go far, just up an embankment through some brush to point out very costly farm damage.
This is a 4,000-acre tomato farm. West Coast Tomatoes, one of several farms that they have in Florida.
Strips of rumpled, dirty plastic stretch across a field of mud. They were crisp white lines atop raised beds before the storm. Across southern Florida, Irma washed out vegetable beds that farmers spent millions to prepare. All that has to be cleaned up and redone before plants can go back in the ground.
In southwest Florida, I think we're going to be looking at somewhere around a $2 billion hit.
And McAvoy says these setbacks are coming after years of Florida tomatoes losing ground against cheaper imports. And it's even worse in the orange business. Florida orange growers were already reeling from a big drop in demand and a decade of disease. Then Irma comes along and ruins most of this year's harvest.
Citrus greening, vegetables have taken over in first place. It was hurting before Irma, but Irma kicked it while it was down.
So the hurricane made things worse for Florida farmers, and it may accelerate some fundamental changes in the way this state grows food.
Agriculture is going to have to adapt. It's going to have to change. We're probably going to do more with the local market, you know, target the high end.
Part of that change McAvoy has in mind looks a lot like what's going on near Felda at Circle C Farms.
We are a multi-species pasture grass-fed sustainable farm. Everything we do is 100% pasture grass-fed.
Nicole Kozak raises cattle, sheep, and poultry here. She sells directly to upscale restaurants, clubs, customers. She's standing in an open field littered with hurricane wreckage.
Well, the buildings are mangled, as you can see. They were picked up in the wind, and they were literally tossed end over end and crumpled.
That killed most of the birds inside, thousands of chickens and ducks. It left Kozak with one viable birdhouse. But most of her cattle and sheep survived, and she's already got 2,000 little white tom turkey chicks fanning out in the grass around that one beat-up shed. Kozak says these little dudes will be ready for Thanksgiving, and that'll help get her back on her feet. Things are tougher in the fruit and vegetable business. McAvoy thinks it'll bounce back, too, eventually. But it's clear that Hurricane Irma will leave a lasting scar on Florida agriculture. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris.
Today, President Trump said he thinks that NFL owners are afraid of their players. That was a reference to the ongoing feud between the league and Trump, who said it was a disgraceful of players to kneel during the national anthem. This isn't the first time that sports, politics, and race have come together in America. So let's take a look back with Brian Ballow and Ed Ayers, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Guys, welcome back.
Hi, Jeremy. Great to talk with you.
And let's talk about the history. Much of this ties into race relations. As we can recall, kneeling during the national anthem began when players, namely Colin Kaepernick, wanted to speak out against police violence, largely against black men. But Ed, you say there's a comparison with what happened back in the 19th century with a jockey and a boxing champ.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, sports are the great meritocracy. You can either do it or you can't. And Americans have been torn about what to think about all that, because we think of the Kentucky Derby today, which reads like a pretty white event. But 15 of the first 17 winners of the Kentucky Derby were African-American, building on a long tradition of African-American jockeys. But in the 1890s, one black jockey did so well that white jockeys mobilized against him, and that was kind of the end of that tradition. And then a little bit later, 1912, the undisputed, in terms of skill, boxer in America, Jack Johnson, is so strong that white Americans are looking for the great white hope to knock him out, and they don't find
one. Yeah, first they avoid fighting him.
As long as they
possibly. But they can't put it off. He's doing too well.
Yeah, exactly. But he, too, is then kind of undone by presidential laws, as well as everything else being sort of stacked against him. So, you know, well over 100 years now, American society elevates black athletes. At the same time, it seems deeply ambivalent about their success.
And another example is the track and field athlete Jesse Owens.
Yeah, Jesse Owens goes over to Berlin. The Nazi war machine is building. It's 1936. And he comes away with four gold medals. And this is at a time when the Nazis' virulent racism is very biological. Whites are supposed to be better than blacks, both intellectually and biologically. And, you know, he comes back as, in theory, the great American hero. He has a ticker tape parade, but he faces the same barriers of discrimination that all African Americans faced in the 1930s. And shortly after winning four gold medals, he needs to race horses in order to bring in a little income. He doesn't have the kinds of endorsements, the kind of guaranteed jobs that successful white stars of the Olympics would have at that time.
Yeah, and to tie to today's controversy, people were outraged that Hitler wouldn't shake his hand, but he came back home. He said, well, neither will the president of the United States.
When we talk about race and sports, a lot of people think about the 1968 Mexico City Olympics, and then, of course, Muhammad Ali as well.
Yeah, when we go into the 1960s, coming out of a kind of a period where you've seen Jackie Robinson, and the story America tells itself is that we're overcoming racism, right? But the 1960s begins, well, Cassius Clay, this handsome young black fighter from Kentucky, sort of steals the nation's heart at the Olympics, and he's so funny and brash in an unchallenging way. But then, in 1964, he shocks the nation by announcing his conversion to the Nation of Islam and changes his name to Muhammad Ali, and then 3 years later refuses to be inducted into the Army for Vietnam. The very next year, People will have inscribed in their minds the images of the two U.S. Olympians who are standing on the platform of victory at the end with raised hands and a black glove as the national anthem is playing in protest of racism in the United States.
And, this and is how did people react to that?
People were shocked. People were upset. The response was vitriolic. All of these athletes received death threats. The irony is, increasingly, as the decade went on, a majority of Americans came to question the Vietnam War, for sure. And America did make great strides through the Civil Rights Act and the Housing Act in 1968 towards integration. It never embraced black power, to be sure, but it did come to accept black pride and black history.
And it did come to accept Muhammad Ali as a great American. You need to remember him igniting the Olympic torch in 1996. So if we're wanting to tell an optimistic story about all this, we could trace the path of Muhammad Ali from sort of scapegoat to American hero.
Or if we want to be pessimistic, yes, we could say by the time he lit that torch, he had Parkinson's disease, his hands were shaking, and he was not a threatening young black man.
Right.
So a big part of the story today involves the national anthem. And I wonder, how did we get to that point where the national anthem was played at sporting events in the beginning?
Well, it's been a long road, too, as historians are always wont to say. But the first time the national anthem is played at a big sporting event is the World Series in 1918. But it's not till 1931 that the national anthem becomes the national anthem, you know, until the Star-Spangled Banner actually becomes the official anthem of the United States. I think before this, it seems to me that it was invoked often at wartime, as was 1918. And after World War II is when it really takes off. That's when you start seeing the fusion of patriotism and athletic event.
And I just want to underscore that you saw it because most of those sports fans and most Americans were very patriotic. We had just been locked into this war that came to be known as the Good War. It was good against evil. We won. Americans truly did feel patriotic. When we get to that period we were talking about of Vietnam, it becomes much more unpopular. You actually see the decoupling of patriotism and sports. In fact, in one of the classic documentary films that's made about Vietnam, football is used as a metaphor for the way the war is going to simply grind up people. It's mechanized. It's this gigantic machine. And it's just going to destroy everything in its path, just like a gargantuan football team. And the link between patriotism and sports really was somewhat severed during that period of the late 1960s and the 1970s.
So what makes this current situation with President Trump and the NFL, and by the way, President Trump and the NBA, when you look at what he said about Steph Curry not being invited to the White House anymore after Steph Curry had said he didn't want to go to celebrate his championship, what makes this situation different than these previous moments we've been talking about?
Well, I think one thing that makes it different, Jeremy, is sports and politics have merged in a way that probably will never be untangled again. Vietnam was followed by a rebuilding of the American military. It was followed by a never-ending series of wars. And it was followed by very self-conscious, active subsidies from the federal government to fund things like flyovers, like advertising in the NFL, et cetera.
So entire teams of NASCAR.
Entire teams of NASCAR. That's where much of the money goes.
That's right.
And so the very platform itself has been very politicized, not by African-American athletes protesting, but by the U.S. government using sports as a platform for patriotism. So I don't think it's surprising that people of all views will take a look at that platform, if they're athletes, and say, gee, I think I'm going to use this to draw attention to something political that I care about deeply. And I think what really puts a bow on this, Jeremy, is I've seen so many comparisons to how many Twitter followers LeBron James has and how many Twitter followers President Trump has. And I think that kind of sums up perfectly this intermingling of politics and sports in an era where both parties can go directly to the public. I mean, intravenously.
But is there a risk, you know, if you look at the lessons of history, is there a risk for President Trump, let's say, for going up against this big sports league?
Yeah, no, I think we've been talking about politics and sports. What we're really talking about, patriotism and sports, because politics, really, everybody has treated athletics enterprise with great respect. You know, everybody wants to be on the side of the great American spectacle. This is, you're starting to see partisan identity injected into this in a way, almost like a sporting event, right? You know, that there's people on different sides of this who
soon are, we'll only have red and blue uniforms,
right.
Jeremy.
That's right.
So obviously, I think there are risks in this because, you know, he said in his speech that NFL ratings are declining because people are tuning in to watch him instead. I don't think that would be something he'd want to count on as a long-term trend for the most popular televised sport in the country.
And I just want to underscore something Ed said earlier, and that's the tenuous nature of the status of African-American athletes, no matter how successful they are on the playing field. If there's one thing that history teaches me, it's that no matter how successful those black jockeys were, no matter how successful that African-American boxer was in the early 20th century, that stature in American society can be ripped away quickly.
That's Brian Ballow and Ed Ayers, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Guys, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Scientists say they've picked up the ripples in space and time that were caused by the collision of two massive black holes almost 2 billion years ago. Researchers first observed similar gravitational waves 2 years ago, but this time they had an additional tool, a new observatory in Italy. NPR science correspondent Joe Palca joins us now. Joe, first, just remind us what happens when two black holes collide.
Ooh, it's a mess. I mean, it's a major event in the gravitational space world. Basically, you know, black holes are these things from which nothing can escape, although, well, we'll say that for basic principles. But they have a huge amount of gravity. And when they come close to each other, they kind of inevitably glom together. And what the result of that is this amazing bending of space around the merger of the black holes and the sending off into space of gravitational waves. And that's what was detected, the gravitational waves that emerged from the merger of these two black holes.
And in this case, we got to detect that using an additional detector, one in Italy, because there are two in the United States that have been around for a while.
That's right. So the two in the United States are in Hanford, Washington, and in Louisiana. And the new one is in Tuscany, actually, in Italy. Nice place to go. Hmm. And the waves were detected by the three detectors serially, because the waves sort of swept across the Earth, and the three of them all detected it a few milliseconds apart. Kip Thorne, who's one of the theoretical physicists and the father of the LIGO, the Laser Interferometry Gravitational Wave Observatory, and someone who may win the Nobel Prize next week, I should say, described gravitational waves in a really beautiful way. He said, most of the time space is curved, but it's like looking on an extremely flat ocean. And when you get one of these gravitational waves coming along, it's like a ripple in the ocean, and it just goes past and it's gone. But it was a great image for me of why you don't see these things all the time. And in fact, you do see them, but these are the results of major storms, essentially, and the major storms are detectable in these two observatories.
Why is the study of gravitational waves so significant to scientists?
Well, a lot of reasons, one of the most interesting of which is the fact that gravitational waves, in theory, can be observed from the very first few seconds of the universe. And so it gives you a chance to study the universe. But black holes were a conjecture, and gravity waves were predicted to come from their merger. But, you know, nobody's seen a black hole because you can't really see it, right? It's black. So this is some of the best evidence that these things really do exist, because the prediction says if they exist, they'll make gravity waves. And if they make gravity waves, we should be able to detect them. And now we've detected them.
That's NPR science correspondent Joe Palca. Joe, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, by now you've heard that Hugh Hefner, the creator of Playboy magazine, has died. He was 91 and died yesterday at his home in Beverly Hills. Hefner first published Playboy in 1953 and turned it into a powerhouse media company. In 2007, he launched a reality show called The Girls Next Door. And at the time, he sat down for an interview with NPR's Renee Montagne.
We arranged to meet him at the Playboy Mansion here in L.A., of course. We were ushered into his wood-paneled library. As I was peering at his Picasso and ceramic tiger and family pictures, Hugh Hefner strode in wearing